Welcome to the All IVF Ever Wanted podcast with
Gareth
and
Emma.
That's me. Documenting our next and possibly final round of IVF. This process will be keeping me sane and probably driving Gareth
a little bit crazy.
So we hope that this does also help you guys as well. So enjoy the episode. I'm really excited this week to have Christiana here because I'm like an Instagram girl. I'm on there all the time. I think I've researched my life through it, but I have found this page called Nurture HF, and the information that comes out of this page, I just think I share nearly every single post that they ever put out because it's always amazing, like gold. When you're on this crazy IVF journey, you just don't know where to start, what to do, especially at the very beginning. And I'm, you know, however many rounds in, and I still don't really know. You do your best and it can be really overwhelming. And what I love about the Nurture HF page is that it simplifies things and helps you to understand it, and it doesn't bombard you with jargon, and it helps debunk some of that jargon. So Christiana, who is behind the page, is with me today. And I know that you guys have sent in some questions and we will answer them. But to start, I would love to welcome her and get her to introduce herself to you about what she's doing, the non-profit that she is running, and the page and everything about it, and how did it start. So Christiana, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me. It was really lovely to receive your invitation for this podcast. I'm also a fan of your pages, I should say. So thank you. So I'm an embryologist. So that's what I do. That's what I've trained to do. I started off in research. So I started off in human embryonic stem cell research. And then I moved into embryology because I was really missing the clinical side, and then the communication with the patients. I needed that. I didn't like the very sterile academic environment I was in. So that's how I sort of fell into embryology. Mm-hmm. And Nurture happened after many years of me working as an embryologist and then as an IVF lab director, and realizing that patients didn't have the information they needed. So they started trying to have a baby, then they realized potentially that it was difficult for them to conceive, and then they all of a sudden found themselves on the doorstep of an IVF clinic knowing absolutely nothing about the whole process, about the basics of reproduction even, because no one talks to you about these things. We don't learn it at school. I only found out most things at university while studying to become an embryologist. So there's this huge lack of information, and then they start going through this very intense treatment, both physically and emotionally. And especially 10 years ago, there was nothing. There was no Instagram. I mean, perhaps there was, but it was more for arts, and there wasn't the community that exists now.
No.
And it was really difficult for patients. I can see that. I was on the receiving end because we, the embryologists, we still are. We're sort of the in-between men, women, but between the science and the medical side of things. And we're the ones that get to chat with the patients during the process more. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized this huge gap in fertility education, but also that the patients need support during this process or in the lead up to it, even better. And also the misinformation that's out there, the fantastic marketing that all these IVF clinics are doing, which is brilliant because it's what pays my job. But many of the treatments that are being offered, especially nowadays in the past few years, are mostly unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And we can see that. We can see that in the lab, because we can see that we do sometimes offer treatment that may not be absolutely necessary for specific groups of patients. So that's how Nurture came about. I wanted to create a platform that was free and that offered evidence-based fertility facts. So basically anything to do with the embryology process or the lead up to it, eggs, sperm, the tests, the lab side, this black box that no one knows what goes on in, but yet is, you know, the heart of an IVF clinic and where, you know, where all the magic happens. That's where all the babies are made. Mm-hmm. And I wanted people to have access to that. I wanted them to know that they should know what's going on behind that door. They have a right to. They're paying mm-hmm. money. Most patients are actually paying a lot of money to have mm-hmm. treatment. So they need to know that they have chosen a clinic that is offering them the best possible treatment and care that they can buy. And if they're not paying for it, again, you know, someone is, the government is, if it's state funded, and it's their chance of having a baby. So mm-hmm. they need to be sure that they're getting the best from whichever clinic they're at. And I wanted to help people know what they need to ask, what should be the success rates. And I wanted them to know how they can help themselves and sort of take control of the process, because I think when you're going through fertility treatment, you feel like you don't have any control over what's mm-hmm. happening. You don't have control over your body because, you know, you feel like it's not working the way it should be, and there's most of the time there's nothing you can do about it. And then you're in this process that, again, you have no control over. You have the fertility doctor saying basically you need this and this and that, mm-hmm. and you just go along with it. So mm-hmm. it's a way of me giving back to the patients, giving them some control. I'm hoping that it helps some people. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I have all these followers now, which is amazing. But I really hope that the information I provide is helping someone, because I'm not selling anything. You know, I don't see money coming in. You know, there's no measure of whether nurture is helping anyone other mm-hmm. than the feedback I'm getting mm-hmm. From people, which is great. So yeah, so that was the reason I set it all up, really.
I think it's amazing, because what I think that your page does is I think it enables people, like you say, to be empowered and to advocate for themselves. Because what I know just from my experience and from others that have shared it with me is that you get told that you need to go to a fertility clinic, and you kind of turn up and you just think that they've got all the answers and they're just going to guide you on absolutely everything. And actually, so many rounds in, I'm now learning and now know that you do have to be your own cheerleader. You do have to say, what about this? What about that? But if you haven't got the information, you can't, if it's not in your awareness to ask the question, how can you ask the question? So what I feel your page is doing is empowering people with easy to digest information that is not overwhelming, that does make sense. So you can sit there and think, oh yeah, that piece kind of sounds a bit like my story. Okay, I'll ask that question. So I think your mission is working, because...
No, that's good to know. Yeah. That was another big thing. It was the science, because the science is something that you need to understand if you're going through something. But the way that it's being delivered is really difficult for someone to digest easily. So I'm sort of bridging that. So I'm looking at the scientific papers and I'm just breaking it down and explaining it in simple language so that my mum, my sister, anyone, you know, can understand what I'm trying to say. So that's good to know. Yeah. thank you because
that's what we need. Because the thing is, when someone arrives for fertility treatment, you're normally in a state of overwhelm one way or another. Emotionally, you're kind of maxed out. A lot of people that arrive at fertility treatment have been through a journey before they get there, or they've had the heads up a lot of their life that there's a reason they're going to need it, in which case that's still quite a burden to bear. So either way, people turn up to fertility treatment really under quite a lot of emotional stress already, and yeah. that somewhat squashes your ability to be logical in everything that you're doing. And it's such an emotional process. It's very hard to stay logical about what you're doing.
Yeah.
When the goal on the table is to build your family, expand your family, whatever your goal is in that moment, it's hard to stay unemotional about that, right? And actually, you really need to try and do a bit of that in this journey, because otherwise you can't get the best plan for you.
No, because obviously anyone would pay anything if there was a guarantee that mm-hmm. they would get a live birth mm-hmm. at the end of their treatment. That's our ultimate goal. Mm-hmm. And that's why especially nowadays with all these add-ons, it's so easy to be led astray in a way. And clinics, most of them don't do it on purpose. Obviously, they want to boost their success rates as well. So most IVF clinics want to offer all these add-on treatments because they want their patients to get pregnant. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, you know, it may not be necessary. And that's where all this added information really helps, because you can advocate for yourself. You can ask all the questions, and then you can decide for yourself whether it's something that you're willing to pay extra for, and mm-hmm. whether you think it will help in your specific situation.
With that in mind, let's talk about one of the most asked questions that I got when I put the question box up for the podcast, which was, what's the difference between IVF and ICSI?
Okay.
And why would we do one over the other?
Okay, this is a really big one for me. So ICSI is when we take one sperm. So we select a sperm under very high magnification so that we can see how it's moving and how fast it is in comparison to the other sperms in the same sample. And we select the best one and injects it directly into an egg. But it's a process, so it's not as simple as it sounds. So for ICSI, we have to obviously collect the eggs and take the sperm, and then we prepare the sperm in a certain way. And the eggs have to be, it's called denuded or stripped. Some people call it stripped as well. So we remove the cells that surround the egg after the egg collection so that we can see if the egg is mature or not. And only mature eggs can be injected with the sperm. So once we've done that, once we've stripped the eggs, then we take the sperm and we inject one by one, one sperm into one egg. So that, in theory, bypasses some of the issues that we may have with IVF. IVF is where it's called conventional routine IVF. So it's where we put the eggs along with the sperm sample in a Petri dish and just allow it to incubate overnight. So we don't do anything with the eggs. We take them. Once you've had your egg collection, we take the eggs, we put them in a tube or any type of container. Each lab may use different things. And then they stay in an incubator until the time of fertilization. The sperm is purified and prepared as we would do for ICSI. And then a couple of eggs go into a drop, usually two or three, depending. Each lab will have their own protocols again. And you'll add sperm, thousands of sperm to each drop. And then you'll just let them do whatever they would do under normal conditions in the uterus. So IVF is a much simpler process, mm-hmm. and it involves less handling as well, and less time outside of the incubator. So the main thing, what affects our eggs and the sperm and our embryos and what we think causes the slow development, for example, or fragmentation, all the adverse effects that we see on gametes and embryos are mostly due to the environment they're in. They're not in their normal environment. So mm-hmm. the conditions we create in the incubator, great, they're under low oxygen, the right temperature, but the minute we take them out, they're in the ambient atmosphere. So mm-hmm. whatever temperature I'm exposed to in the lab, the eggs and the sperm and the embryos will be exposed to too. Yeah, we have heated stages, but we have to physically remove them from an incubator, carry them across a room, place mm-hmm. them onto a heated stage, and then denude them if it's for ICSI, take them back to the incubator, take them out again afterwards. Whilst we're injecting, the dish is sat there on a heated stage, but again, exposed to the ambient environment. So they're exposed to a lot of stress.
Yeah.
So ICSI sounds, it's great for people who actually need it. So up until 1992, when it was first used, people who had severe male factor infertility or previous total fertilization failure with IVF, that was it for them. There was no technology available for them to actually be able to have a baby by IVF, because mm-hmm. IVF did not work. So it's absolutely brilliant for a really specific group of patients who under normal circumstances wouldn't have been able to have treatment. Mm-hmm. But what we're seeing is now it's used for almost 70% of patients, well, of treatments, not patients, treatments mm-hmm. worldwide. Mm-hmm. Now that's scary. Mm-hmm. And it's scary because we've been doing it since 1992. So the oldest person created by ICSI is probably in their 30s now, which, okay, we have data that shows that, you know, that there aren't any severe adverse effects or more so than natural conception, but we don't know what the long-term health implications are for children born after ICSI. We don't know what kind of epigenetic changes are happening and how they're happening and why. So that's a mystery to us. So we know they're happening. We just, you know, we don't know the specifics yet.
Mm-hmm.
And we know ICSI's been linked with some imprinting syndromes, like Angelman syndrome, for example. Mm-hmm. It's very rare. It's still under 1%, but we know that it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the damage to the eggs. So a patient who doesn't have very many eggs, if we denude them and they're found to be immature, for example, at the point that we choose to strip the eggs, then they won't be able to be used. And we can't do IVF on them either. So they're gone. It's finished.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whereas with IVF, by incubating the eggs overnight, eggs that are immature at the time of egg collection or mm-hmm. shortly after, where we would be doing the denudation, for example, have the chance to mature overnight. And we know the sperm's going to survive, so they might become fertilized along with eggs that were already mature. So you're giving those immature eggs a chance as well.
Okay.
And the other thing is embryo quality. So there have been recently papers comparing, and we know that there's no difference in live birth between IVF and ICSI.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a no-brainer, really. Why put your eggs under the additional stress of being ICSI'd if you can just have IVF? And the embryos are better quality normally. So with IVF, what we're seeing in the lab is if sometimes we do split cases. So if a patient has 20 or 30 eggs on rare occasions, we would split them.
Just for the record, those numbers blow my mind.
It happens. It doesn't happen often, but it does happen. And for those cases, especially if it's unexplained infertility, where mm-hmm. we don't know why the patient isn't getting pregnant, then we may split the case and inject half of the eggs with ICSI and the other half will be IVF'd.
Mm-hmm.
And comparing those sibling eggs, we can see that the group that are derived from the IVF fertilization are much better. They form better blastocysts. They're more resilient. You can actually, when you're handling embryos, you can actually feel them in a way. It's really weird. I can't really explain how it is, but I think over the years you get this feeling for how the embryo moves and its elasticity in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell whether an embryo is good quality, and not just by looking at it. You can, there's this feeling you have, which, you know, it doesn't mean it's going to end up, you know, and lead into a live birth. But you can see that morphologically, the IVF embryos are better in some cases, not always, but in most cases, they are better than the ICSI ones when you're comparing from the same group of eggs. So I think IVF is great.
Mm-hmm.
ICSI is also great for a specific group of patients. If you have a choice,
that would be more what if we didn't have sperm moving in the right direction or things like this.
So ICSI, for example, I had someone ask today on Nurture if a sample was severely if it was morphologically abnormal, would you go for ICSI? And yeah, if it was severely morphologically abnormal, I would, because that means that perhaps the head isn't the right shape, or the neck, or the tail. Mm-hmm. And all of this wouldn't allow the sperm to move in the right way. So it wouldn't be able to propel itself towards the egg. Or maybe there's an issue with the formation of the acrosome, the tip of the head. And that's really important, because if that's not working properly, then the sperm can't create the enzymes and digest its way through the zona of the egg to actually get inside it. So, mm-hmm. so that's the risk with IVF, and especially in case of unexplained infertility. You can have total fertilization failure. It can happen. Or you can have very low fertilization. And if that happens in your first cycle, then yes, ICSI probably would be your next step. So mm-hmm. it's great for lots and lots of people, but not for everyone. For example, advanced maternal age isn't an indication for ICSI, or a low ovarian reserve isn't an indication for ICSI. If anything, if you've got very few eggs, and everything else is fine, and the sperm is looking brilliant as well, then it's better to just IVF and see what happens. But the risk, I think the fear is, and it's the specialists, I think, that get involved. The embryologists, we know this, because we're the ones in the lab, we see what happens. But the specialist is facing the patient and they need to deliver, as we do. But there's only so much we can do with what we're given. So we're given a set of eggs and some sperm and we have to make it work. But there's only so much we can do. There are two processes that we can choose from. But I think that the fertility specialist, especially of today's IVF world, have so much pressure because there is so much technology out there and ICSI is there and it's on offer and they can choose and they can tell the lab, I want ICSI for this patient because they're afraid of fertilization failure or really low fertilization. And it's totally understandable, but I think counseling the patient properly from the beginning sort of alleviates that problem, because if they start off understanding that potentially that IVF, for example, might be better in the long run overall, but the risk is yes, because we don't know what the problem is. It could be that the sperm isn't able to get inside the egg and that's why they haven't been able to conceive naturally. So that's the risk. I think the main risk for me is the fertilization failure, because even if you get low fertilization, those 1, 2, 3 eggs that do fertilize still have potential to become a blastocyst and lead to a pregnancy. I think that the big worry and the risk of IVF is total fertilization failure, where your cycle has ended before it's even begun in a way.
Yeah. I mean, for us, ours didn't end there, but ours didn't get to blastocyst. So, but for example, on our last cycle, I had 8 eggs. 6 were mature. So of course, because it was ICSI, 2 got discarded straight away. So only 6 could be injected, but then only 3 of those fertilized and the other 3, I don't know, didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't actually get a proper explanation as to what happened there. But so I don't actually know why that was, but they didn't give me a reason why those 3 didn't fertilize or whatever. But is it that when you inject them, you know straight away if it's gone well or not?
No. Well, sometimes. So sometimes you'll have eggs where when you inject, immediately you'll see something called cytoleakage, where the membrane of the egg breaks and the inside of the egg slightly leaks out. And you know that egg probably won't survive and it will degenerate soon after. So in those cases, yes. And that's the risk of ICSI. But otherwise, you have to wait till the next day. Sometimes it goes well, and all the factors that you're looking at that should indicate whether the egg will fertilize or not, or you speculate whether it will or not, are there. And then you're surprised the next morning when you see no fertilization. So what could happen is there could be no fertilization, or there could be abnormal fertilization. So when we check the eggs the day after we either inject or IVF them, we want to see 2, and they're called pronuclei. So it's the maternal and paternal nucleus in the middle of the egg. And that shows us that the egg has fertilized normally. Sometimes you might only see 1, or sometimes you might see 3 or even 4, which it indicates abnormal fertilization. So those eggs are disregarded.
Okay.
So they don't continue monitoring those, because that's an indication that the egg has the wrong number of chromosomes in it, because each nucleus you assume has the respective amount of chromosomes, and then they combine and make the embryo, the zygote. So that's probably what happened in your case. They either degenerated or they showed signs of abnormal fertilization. And that's quite normal. I mean, you can see that after IVF as well. And it's sometimes possible for more than one sperm to get into the egg. What would happen, the normal process is that once a sperm has entered, the egg goes through this reorganization and sort of makes its shell really hard and blocks the entry of any other sperm going in. But sometimes that might not work. So it's not something that we see only with ICSI, but you can see it with IVF as well. So it's just, it's either the wrong number of chromosomes in the egg, wrong number of chromosomes in the sperm, or more than one sperm entered the egg.
So many things to think about. And it's interesting, the first time you do around IVF, I don't even think I was even thinking about the lab or what was going on in there. It was just like this sort of the eggs and sperm go in there, and then, you know, something pops out or might or might not pop out the other side. But there's like this sort of big void of unknown in the middle.
Yeah.
And I think it is good for people to try and understand it, you know, because otherwise you've had your eggs taken, the sperm's gone in, and you just sort of, you know you're waiting for news, but you don't really know what you're waiting for or what it means or why.
Or when you should be getting your news. Yeah.
That's true, yeah. So it's just difficult to understand certainly the first time around for me. I didn't really know what I was asking. I was like waiting for these updates. I'm thinking, well, what do they even mean? You know, what do these updates even mean? So yeah, it's an interesting process from the patient point of view to get your head around. And what you were saying earlier about how you didn't learn half of what you know about our reproductive health and education until you were studying it. It's interesting that you say that, because when we first started going through fertility treatment, I was talking to my friends about how many follicles I had and antral follicles and how many were growing. And they were going, what are follicles? You know,
what are they?
And they go, where are they? You know, and this is women. And actually, yeah. I've come away from this now at the stage that we're at, and I'm putting the fertility issues to the side. It's actually mind-blowing that we don't know how we reproduce or what our organs are doing to achieve that.
Yeah.
Or how we ovulate or how that works. And I've only had to learn this because I'm in this space. But actually, as a uterus owner, it's something that we should know, you know?
Yeah, no, like, definitely.
I don't think I should get to the age of 35 and not know how I ovulate.
Just but I think that's where we're going wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that's where sex education or fertility education or whatever they call it nowadays at schools, that's where they're going wrong, because we're leaving school at 18, not knowing all of these things.
Oh.
And you're taught everything about how not to conceive.
Yes.
And nothing about how to actually plan for your future family, which is so important.
Yeah.
So important. And that's why it's all going wrong. And that's why I'm really pleased with social media. It was very apprehensive to start off with. But this is a way of people learning all of these things much earlier than we did. Because even I, you know, I didn't know half of it. I studied as an embryologist. I struggled to conceive my firstborn. And I was really surprised when it happened, because you just don't expect it to happen to you.
No.
You might hear about it, but you never think it's going to happen to you. But yet, one in six are actually experiencing this. So it's great that people are talking, but it needs to be done properly. And women and men, young adults, need to be taught all of these things, because most people will want a family. So they need to know that there are things that you can check when you're in your early 20s, for example, so that you know whether you need to start trying to have a family sooner, or whether you have the luxury of waiting until you've ticked all the boxes and you've done everything that you wanted to achieve, you know, in life before you move on to the family box, which for my age group, in my 40s, it was left behind, because you just assumed that it can happen anytime. No one told you any different.
No.
So no, I'm really, really, really passionate about it. And there are some great people in the fertility world doing a lot on this, like Joyce Harper, lots of initiatives going on to sort of increase early fertility education, because we all know how not to get pregnant. I think that's been established. You speak to a 12, 13-year-old, they'll know. They also need to know, you know, what they need to do if they do want to have a family in the future.
Yeah.
And that it might not be easy. Not everyone will conceive so easily as they, you know, the way as it's portrayed. It's not easy for many people.
It was interesting. We had a friends over, and they've got two girls. And I suppose one must be 8 and the other one must be 11 now. And they came to Dubai, and we went out for dinner, and we were in the middle of a cycle. So, you know, we were talking about it. And I suppose Gareth and I have got very used to, because we're really open about everything that's going on, we're very used to just talking about it. And I'm not saying that everyone should. Everyone, you know, there's being private and there's being open, and everyone's entitled to do what they want to do. For us, this is easier. So we're just talking about it as normal as bread, butter, cheese, milk, you know, on the table. Yeah. And the girls were listening, intently listening. So obviously they've got some awareness of, you know, sexual health and, you know, their bodies and what's going on. And the youngest one, Tamara, she said, but why is this so difficult? I didn't realise having babies was so difficult. Yeah. And I said, well, actually, it's not difficult for everybody, but it's important to understand that it's not easy for everybody either. And sometimes for some people it is difficult. And then we were talking more and I was saying, you know, if we are blessed to have children, I think in their mid-20s, one of my birthday presents will be, let's go down to the fertility place, yeah, like a dentist and get a checkup. Yeah. You know,
or get yearly checkups. You know, you can check nowadays if you're at the age where you're considering, you know, if it's an option, that's the time you need to start checking for these things.
Mm-hmm.
So many women, especially with premature ovarian insufficiency, and there are so many conditions that you may have not even know. Yes, you'll have signs eventually, but by the time you start exhibiting those signs, it might be too late.
Yeah.
So we really
in that
need
space
to,
already.
Yeah, we need to get in there early.
Yeah, I would love to normalize it in our family if we're blessed enough to have one, as like you would going to the dentist, like you would going to have a health checkup. I don't see why reproductive health is any less important.
No.
You know, and a lot of it, I think a lot of symptoms that can cause infertility are attributed to being young and hormonal as well.
And
that's not great, you know, because actually they could be quite serious underlying issues on, and we're just bringing it down to people being young and wild, and it's like, well, not always,
but
right?
It's preventative healthcare.
Yes.
And that's what governments need to realize, and especially insurance companies that don't cover IVF, you know. You need to start covering all of these things. They need to start covering fertility checkups and workups and everything, because it's preventative healthcare, so that these patients don't need treatment in 10, 15 years time.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much we can talk about on this. It's such a big subject.
A whole other podcast. So I'm going to ask another couple of questions, if that's okay.
Sure.
So what tests should we have done on sperm and why? And the reason I'm bringing this up is because a lot of the focus when we get into the infertility arena is on the woman. And I find it absolutely mind-blowing that we don't really stop to look at the man in the equation till we're quite far down the line.
Yeah.
So what do you think about that? What tests should we be doing?
The first test would be a semen analysis. I think even before the female patient gets to the IVF clinic, because if the simplest factor and one of the most common that might be not right is the sperm. So we know that male factor infertility accounts for a huge amount of fertility cases. So a semen analysis, but not just one. That's another big thing for me. I see so many patients hanging on to that one semen analysis, or fertility clinics basing their whole treatment on one semen analysis. It doesn't work like that, because sperm quality can fluctuate. So it can fluctuate throughout the year, it can fluctuate from week to week, from day to day, depending on how many days abstinence the patient had, depending on how much alcohol, how many cigarettes they had in the past, the weeks prior to their appointment. Mm-hmm. There are so many factors, their diet, stress. Sperm is impacted by everything, by everyday life. So ideally, I would say a semen analysis, just to have a starting point and figure out where the patient is at. And then a second one around 6 weeks later, just to reaffirm the first semen analysis results. So I think ideally two separate semen analysis with similar abstinence days, where I don't agree with the World Health Organization recommendations, is that they recently changed them for semen quality, because they give us parameters that we measure sperm samples against to see what's normal or not, as the days of abstinence. So traditionally, they used to say you need to have between 2 to 7 days, and they made it 2 to 5 days. And they've kept it at 2 to 5 days, sometimes even 6 days. But I don't agree with that. I find, especially for patients who may have increased sperm DNA fragmentation or issues with motility, the best thing is to have 2 to 3 days as a maximum. Mm-hmm. So that's one. So 2 semen analysis and shorter abstinence periods and a good sort of lifestyle in the lead up to them. Because if you're having a really unhealthy lifestyle and then you go bang in the middle of it and have a semen analysis, it's bound to be bad.
Yes.
So because it all affects the way the sperm will move, the quantity of the sperm, everything. But the good news is with sperm is that it's produced every 74 days. So potentially until men are in their 70s. So we do see a reduction in quality over time because initially people and scientists, you know, the data told us, oh, sperm is good until men are well into their 70s. Well, actually it's not. And we know that now. So time does tick for men as well. So they do need to consider that. But the good news is that they can have an impact on their sperm. So by maintaining a healthy lifestyle, their diet, there's all these different supplements that men can take now, even hormones. There's a lot of things that can be done with sperm, but it's really important to work with a good urologist because men with infertility are a really unique group of patients. They get treated by a gynecologist fertility specialist, which does not make sense because they're not specialized to treat male infertility, but they end up treating the male patient too. And that's traditionally how it's always happened. It's very rare that a patient will get referred to a urologist. So they'll only get referred if they have a really serious condition or azoospermia or something seriously wrong with their sperm. But I think that needs to change as well. So I think the male partner needs to go to a urologist, whether they have an issue or not. They might have a lump or something that needs to be seen to, a varicose cell, an undiagnosed one. So there are lots of things that can be done in the workup to actually leading to a going to a fertility clinic. So yeah, men need to see a urologist. They could potentially skip it if they have 2 semen analyses and everything's okay, then perhaps not. But if they're borderline or if there's something wrong in terms of really low sperm count, for example, they might be referred for hormonal tests. They might, there are so many things that might be wrong that they may not know about. So that's really important for me. And sperm DNA fragmentation, that's another one. So that's something that's become quite popular recently, and rightly so, because it's something that we can't see. And we know that men with normal semen analysis can have high sperm DNA fragmentation. And I think when we started becoming suspicious about this and when the data, when scientists started caring, is when we realized that good quality embryos and good quality eggs weren't making blastocysts. And that's an indication that perhaps there is an issue with the sperm as well. Because if you have a young patient who phenotypically, a female patient who phenotypically has nothing wrong, and you have a semen analysis that's borderline or it's good, then you know, it's not always the egg. We're really fast to lay the blame. Oh, it's egg quality. But what do we measure egg quality by? The only way to measure egg quality is to try and fertilize the egg. And then if it fertilizes, make a blastocyst. And if that doesn't happen, then there are different indications as to what may have gone wrong. So that's another good one to do before starting out, because if you know from the beginning that perhaps there is high sperm DNA fragmentation, that's something that patients can work to resolve before they actually go into the process of spending thousands of pounds on treatment that potentially won't work because of the DNA fragmentation, and they end up finding out about it 2 or 3 treatments down the line.
Which is kind of our story, right? Like, so it's interesting because when we started fertility treatment, yes, there's an issue on my side, but it was then because there was an issue on my side, there was nothing else looked at on Gareth's side at all. So it's just assumed that he's tip top perfect. And he didn't have a physical examination. He didn't, you know, he had the sperm analysis one, and the feedback to him was, oh, you've got amazing sperm. within the parameters of a normal sperm analysis, which is what you're not told. So of course Gareth skips away thinking, yep, I've got amazing sperm, nothing wrong
That's
with
it.
My job's done. And you know, but why would he think anything else if that's what he's been told?
Yeah.
But it's within the parameters of what that test can see. But what I've learned now, where we're at, is the DNA fragmentation. You can't see that in a normal sperm analysis.
No.
It might move well. It's a bit like a human being, isn't it? They look good on the outside, but they might have something really wrong going on the inside, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
So unless we investigate further, we're not actually going to know what's beneath the skin of it all. I find the whole sperm DNA fragmentation quite interesting. And I just feel like society, unfortunately, leans towards, if you say that to a man, yes, your sperm's amazing, it's kind of that's the curiosity will stop there. It's like, well, it's not me then, do you know? And I've heard that from lots of people, that their partners won't look at it any further because they've been told on one semen analysis that their sperm's amazing.
That's fine.
And that's the words that come out from practitioners, your sperm's amazing. So of course the guy walks out thinking, I've aced this and I never need to look at it again. But it's just not always the case, right?
And what else that people need to consider is that different labs will look at sperm in different ways. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of just basic labs offering semen analysis where you would normally just get a blood test. They're not specialized in looking at sperm. They're not andrologists. Most IVF clinics will have a person who is specialized, whose job it is day in, day out, to sit there and look at sperm samples. Some places might have a machine where they put a sliding and the machine measures. You'll get if you took the same sample to these three different places, you'd probably get a different result for all three. Mm-hmm. It would probably be along the same lines. So it wouldn't be massively different, but it would be different.
Mm-hmm.
But where it becomes a problem is for samples that could be borderline. So one lab may say, yeah, you're fine. Another lab may measure it and say, actually, no, you would only be suitable for ICSI, for example. So there are different cutoffs as well. Mm-hmm. So that's really important to know. So I personally always ask for a repeat analysis in my lab, because I know who's looking at the sample and I know that what we look at is sort of the quality that we're going to get. Because if you base treatment on just a random lab's semen analysis, most of the time it's quite different to what you expect. And it could be the way they're measuring, but it could also be the fluctuations in sperm quality, which we do see. So that's why two semen analysis are so important to get a good idea of the actual quality of the specific male is producing.
And also what you were saying about the sperm DNA fragmentation, and not, you know, going to somebody that is a urologist andrologist and having your test done with somebody that actually that's their area, not someone who specializes in female fertility, infertility, which actually I hadn't really thought about until you just said it then. But that's absolutely the case. You know, Gareth's had to go to a urologist andrologist, you know, to have his test done, to get the proper feedback, not to the fertility clinic, to my consultant. You know, she's not giving advice to Gareth. He's had to go somewhere else for that advice. Yeah.
That's super important, and it's great for people to know that from the beginning, so that they take it step by step and potentially save themselves a treatment or two, even
time, money, heartache, all of it.
Yes, all everything.
All of it. And then the last question that I have for you is, what should we be asking about the lab conditions when we're choosing a clinic? Because I'll be honest, first time round didn't even enter my head, because like I said, it was just like, just goes through the doors of the lab and then something might pop out the other side. I didn't understand there was different types of, you know, some people put the embryos in and out on day three, day five. I didn't know that. Some places leave them in. I had no idea. I have a smidgen of an idea now, but I had no idea at the beginning. What's important and what questions should we be asking to get the best chances of success?
I think obviously success rates, but success rates, live births per embryos transferred. So that's a real success rate. How many embryos they transferred, how many sacs they see on the ultrasound, how many heartbeats they have, and if they end up with a baby at the end of it. They take home a baby. So they will have these results. Most clinics keep the KPIs, key performance indicators, and they will be able to hopefully share the real statistic. So that's one, success rates, really important. And then the way the embryos are cultured. So some labs, for example, might not be very keen on Glasser's culture, for example, in this day and age. Some may still not be keen on offering that. So for example, for patients who have few eggs and end up with one or two embryos, they might be keen to transfer on day three or even day two in some cases. So I think it's important to discuss that at the beginning, because certain patients who are a bit more educated will have an idea and they might want to transfer blasts because they've read that it will give them a slightly higher implantation rate. So I think discussing the protocols that will be used is important in the lab. Obviously, patients will discuss the drug regimen that they'll take, but often the part that happens in the lab will be overlooked.
And it definitely is overlooked, definitely is. Especially in the early cycles, for sure. Yeah.
And then the conditions the embryos will be cultured in. So find out what type of incubators the lab has. If they have big box incubators, that's a no-go. Embryos shouldn't be cultured in those. We know that they don't work well. They take forever to recover once you've opened the door once. It could take hours for them to restabilize. So nowadays, most IVF labs will have benchtop incubators with low oxygen, and they'll closely mimic what happens inside the patient. So that's one. Also, time lapse. So this is not, for me, it's not a deal breaker. But if there is a time lapse incubator, which is where the embryos are put in a little dish and the incubator section they're put into has a camera on top that snaps pictures of the embryos as they grow at specific time points, normally every couple of minutes. And then you get like a video of the whole development of the embryo. So these incubators work well. They're good incubators. They're low oxygen. They're the latest technology. But most of the time, the patients don't know whether they'll get cultured inside them, because maybe the lab has one time lapse and a majority of just regular bench tops, and they have their own protocols as to who gets to go inside the time lapse. So that's something else to discuss. Some places charge extra if the patient wants their embryos to be cultured in the time lapse. So that's another important question. Now, lab conditions, we know what they are, what they should be. But I don't think any lab would share that information with a patient. I would for my lab, but not everyone will. But we know that it needs to be kept warm. It needs to be at a specific temperature, preferably dimmed light. You know, there's no light inside us. And yet when we are looking at embryos or eggs or sperm, we have a light shining right under them because that's how we look at them under the microscope. So that in itself might be stressful. So dimmed lighting, there's lots of different factors. Good air quality, crucial. So many papers showing what detrimental effect it can have on even the progress of a pregnancy potentially. So that's really important. Does the lab have VOC filters to filter out all the volatile organic compounds? Does it have air purifiers? And there are so many little extras that can make a big difference to whether you end up with a good quality embryo. We can actually introduce aneuploidy, genetic abnormality, to the eggs and the sperm and the embryos in the way in which we handle them, which is mind-blowing, but we know it happens. So it's crucial to have a good lab, but it's really difficult to know. I get this question so much on nurture as well. How do we know? But will they give us their KPIs? I don't know. I hope so. But I don't know. And there's no, I mean, I don't know what happens in my friend's lab. I know that they might be good. They're good embryologists. They've got good equipment. But I don't know how each embryologist handles the embryos and the sperm and the eggs, and we're all different. We do things in embryology. There are protocols that we follow, obviously, but everyone has their own way of doing things. So it will be the same, but the way that I handle my strip of a pet might be slightly different, and that might cause stress to the embryo. So there are all these little things that we may do without even knowing that might have an impact. So a good lab overall will have a good live birth rate. That's the measure of success, whether the patient actually gets to take home her baby, because you can have a whole load of positive HCGs, but that means nothing unless the pregnancy progresses and goes to term and is a live birth. Obviously we have no control over it, but what we've done in the lab might impact that. Biochemical pregnancies, for example, we know that they've been linked with pH fluctuations in the lab. So if you look at your KPIs and you've got a string of biochemical pregnancy, then it makes you stop and think, is there a problem with my media? Is the pH at the correct point? So there are all these checks that you have to keep doing to make sure that you're on top of things and you're really providing a good service to your patients. So I think KPI, just make, I think patients need to make sure their lab is monitoring things. That's the only way that they will know if there's an issue, because there are labs that don't do that. There are labs that don't keep KPIs and don't measure their pH often and just plod along, especially really busy ones, which are popular, but they might not be doing all these checks all the time because they don't have the time to.
And
that's the other thing with very popular clinics, and people sometimes ask me, it's in a smaller clinic and will it be okay? Sometimes it might actually be better. You don't need to always be at the big, busy clinic, because the smaller clinic sometimes will offer that more personalized treatment, and the incubators won't be overcrowded. That's another thing. If there are lots of people going in and out of the lab, then there'll be lots of embryos being stored with your embryos at the same time. So there are so many things to consider. And then there are sometimes, you know, patients won't be able to choose where they go for treatment. In the UK, for example, they won't have a choice of where to go. But sometimes asking the right questions might help them get the best from their specific clinic, because all clinics work towards, you know, the best possible result.
So many things to think about. Everything that you've just said there about labs wasn't even, because I think as a patient, certainly as the person that's having your eggs collected, all you can think about is getting to egg collection. Like, how am I going to get through this? And then the rest, you just kind of unknowingly surrender over and don't even question, especially in the early rounds for me. Because you don't,
but it is too much though.
Yes.
But it is too much. I mean, that's for us to worry about. It's not for the patients to worry about, but it's nice for them to know. And I think it's nice for them to know that we are worrying about it. We do worry about it. And I don't think there's an embryologist anywhere that doesn't and doesn't really do their best to offer the best quality treatment they can. But of course, when you're going through it, no, you're not going to, but you shouldn't really be needing to.
No, but I do think it's important when you're trying to choose a clinic, you know, to know that, for example, that your embryos aren't going to get pulled in and out, you know, that maybe they can just be left like the time-lapse one, you know, that they're going to just stay in that continuous environment, for example, if you are choosing your, if you are choosing your clinic. And then the other thing that I wanted to ask you about, which is just something that is coming to my awareness, is extended culture for embryos. And this sort of, I was reading that they can day six, day seven, day eight, if they're extended enough, if they're showing signs of growth, can actually turn into a blastocyst. I mean, what is that? Do you think that's the case? Is that true?
They can. I would say day seven is the top end of the limit. Sometimes they can, slow growing embryos, but they would definitely need to be frozen. So, for example, I would routinely culture to day six and push it to day seven if we didn't have blastocyst development, but I could see an early blastocyst forming. Embryos that are cleavage stage, so they're still cell stage at that point, had probably stopped developing by then.
Yeah.
But I don't see a reason why not. So, and a lot of clinics I know of internationally now are stretching to day seven, because mm-hmm. day six, we know we've had pregnancies, we freeze embryos routinely on day six now.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen a couple of day sevens as well. They've been papers, you know, it can happen. Mm-hmm. So why not? I mean, it's a chance of a pregnancy mm-hmm. and it's a chance that wouldn't be there a few years ago. So yeah, no, I'm definitely pro extended culture in certain situations. And the embryologist can tell, we know which embryos we should. Normally though, a group of embryos will be cultured together. Even if you know that they've stopped developing for a specific patient, you will push the whole group to day six or to day seven and then see what happens. You wouldn't select out. So they would all get a chance to make it to blastocyst stage by whichever day you choose as your limit.
I tell you what, there's nothing more nerve-wracking than those phone calls. They're just, oh my gosh, they are something else.
I know, it's hard being on the other end as yeah. well, because you know that the person is hanging on every single word you say and the tone yes. of your voice and how you say good morning. And
oh God,
it's
yes.
everything. I know. It's and it's really, it's a lot of pressure. On
I know, I can imagine. Honestly, everything you're saying is right though, because from the minute that phone goes, you're like, and you listen to it, how they say hello, you're listening yeah. to, you're right. As the patient, you're listening. Did that sound happy? Did that sound happy? Or did that sound stressed? You know, and you're just like analysing it, you know, just, yeah. So, I mean, from your point of view, I'm really curious to know how that feels for you, because, yeah, how
it's
do you feel?
Amazing
being on the other
when
side?
It's good news.
Oh,
when it's
yeah.
good news, it's amazing. I'm normally... tears of happiness on the other end as well. No, it's honestly, it's the most amazing feeling when you're giving good news to someone.
Mm.
But when you're not, it's the absolute worst, because you're the bearer of bad news.
Yeah.
So, and each patient will obviously react differently. And at that point, you're who they have on the line. You are their point of contact. So you're the person that has to give the bad news, and then you have to sort of be on the other end of the line and just stay there until you feel that the patient is okay enough to say okay and put the phone down. Or, you know, many times the phone will just go dead, or the patient will be sobbing.
Gosh.
Or, and there's, you can't do anything. It's, it's just awful. And the other thing that I think is completely wrong is that we don't receive any type of training as to how to deliver bad news.
I was about ask you that, actually.
No, there's nothing. I don't know if things have changed in recent years, but obviously I trained more than 15 years ago now, and there was nothing. We would just sit with the senior embryologist at the time and listen to them speak to patients and
copy
what they were saying. Mm-hmm. There was nothing. There was no training, which is dreadful, really, because we're given such big news to people. And
massive.
When it's bad news, it's devastating. And we don't know what to say to make the patient feel better. We know nothing can make her feel better, but
mm-mm.
embryologists need to be equipped with knowledge to deal with scenarios like that. No, it's absolutely awful. That's why I've written a post about this a few years ago about what it means to be an embryologist. And it can be the most amazing job in the world when it works.
Yes.
When it doesn't, it's the worst. It's the worst because... And the lab is always blamed for everything, by the way. That's the other inside secret no one knows. So when things don't work out, what did you do wrong? You know, it's always
no!
the lab's fault. So embryologists have all of that to deal with, and the pressure, uh-huh. and, you know, the stress. And obviously it's not as stressful as going through this treatment, but you want it to work so badly. You become so invested with patients that you probably haven't even met. But you do. It's just the nature of the job. And then when it doesn't work, it's awful, and you're the one that has to deliver the worst news. So it's a roller coaster.
You know, and it's funny, obviously the space I'm in at the moment, I'm not in the middle of a cycle. I've got the capacity to think about other people, right? Because when you're in the middle of a cycle, I definitely didn't have the capacity to think about
No.
that person giving me that news, or because you just can't, you're maxed out. But in the space I'm in now, I have the space to, you know, be curious about that and be open about that and think, oh gosh, how is that for you? And I'm actually a bit shocked that you don't get any kind of training on how to handle that, not only for the patient, but for you too.
Yeah.
Because those patients I know firsthand are, this could be like the end of their world as they know it, because it could be their last ever cycle. They may have,
and many times it is
again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's life-changing conversations. Mm. And that's big for,
I think,
both
we're
parties
only,
right?
But we're only talking about it now, right? Mm. This, we've only become open about what it means to go through treatment as an IVF patient in the past 2, 3, 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember any of these conversations being public before then.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't talk about it. IVF patients didn't talk about the heartache of it. They didn't talk about it full stop to anyone, even their friends or their families.
Yeah.
So I think it's shocking that we don't receive that, but it's not surprising, because we've only just started talking about the emotional side of things and actually acknowledging the trauma that the patients go through and the impact and the long-term trauma. You know, it doesn't switch off once you've had your baby either. So there's so much, and I think there's so much more to come. Mm-hmm. It's such an ever-developing field, and ongoing education for both sides. You know, patients need to be educated, but we do too, and it's a constant evolution. We need to keep up with things.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be great if we did receive that type of training, but in my time we didn't. Perhaps things have changed now though. I don't know, so don't quote me.
No, I won't.
Maybe they are now. Maybe the new embryologists are, hopefully.
But it's like a two-way street, you know, like you're saying, the patient needs to be more informed, and then the people that are actually put in these positions like yourselves that have to deliver this life-changing news, it would be good for them to have a bit more awareness of but in more of a collaborative kind of feel to it all, really.
And support for the patient, so that when that does happen, you can say, you know, our clinic has an amazing support service. This is the number. If you feel like talking, this is the person you can get in touch with. Mm-hmm. I think that's what's lacking in a lot of places as well. So we've got all the technology to the T. We know what we're doing. We're developing embryos to the blastocyst stage. You know, we're doing everything right in that respect to a certain point, as far as we can.
Mm.
But we need to extend that emotional support as well to the patient, because that's a big thing as well. It's enormous, life-changing, as you said.
Mm.
It really needs to be addressed, and it's not currently. No. I mean, in our region, it definitely isn't. In Europe, 10 years ago, it wasn't. It's catching up in some places, but it's definitely not where it should be.
Mm-hmm. And it is, yeah, I mean, the impact of it, it's a bit like going through a cycle is a bit like, I don't know, there's all this build up, and it's so, the momentum is crazy. And the closer you get, it's just, and then it's this tension of waiting for the news, waiting for the news, waiting for the news. And when there's a no at the end, it's just like radio silence. And that's quite a difficult space to be in as a patient, where it's, you feel like you've been like a steam train charging and charging and charging along. And then all of a sudden the track just stops, but the train
keeps
going. But we're the train and we just keep going. But there's no track to carry on guiding you, and you just wait till you hit something and then sob for however long.
Yeah.
But, you know, so yeah, you're right.
That's why we need to, and it's the clinics, we need to have that safety net that you drop into at the end of that. And there's a whole load of support for you there. And then you pick yourself up and you decide if you want to go ahead again or if not. But there's none of that now.
No.
In the UK, I know, some places have started providing that, which is great. And obviously lots of Instagram accounts now offer that support, which is also really lovely, but it needs to be streamlined and it needs to become routine. It needs to be for everyone, everywhere.
I think it would have a massive impact on how people transition from cycle to cycle or not,
if they decide not to. Exactly. And that's the other big thing no one talks about, right? Because you can reach a point where you don't want to go, or you can't. You know, you physically and emotionally can't.
Yeah.
And again, there's nothing out there for anyone but yet there are so many people living and they're childless, but not by choice.
Yes.
So there's so much to talk about on that as well. It's just, it's enormous. It's enormous. Yeah. And we see it. We see it. And there's nothing that we can do to help. Because we know our patients. Most patients will stay with the same clinic, or they'll move along, or they'll come back. You've got their file and you can see they've had 2, 3, 4 treatments. You know that they're reaching the point where they're probably towards the end.
Yeah.
And yet you, or in my case, me, I have nowhere to direct them to. There's no extra help that we can offer them.
Yeah. It's I think things are getting better slowly, and conversations like this are going to be part of that change, right? Part of that awareness that things need to be different, and just because the cycle comes to an abrupt end, there's things that still need to be taken care of in order to help that patient move perhaps to trying again or to a different pathway. But that
I think what we didn't mention as well, what would be helpful perhaps, is for patients to also have a chat with their embryologist before they either move on or decide to stop. So the fertility specialist, yes, of course, but also have a chat with your embryologist, because they may have made a tiny note on a piece of paper about your egg quality, or about something the embryo did that might have not been what it would normally do. Something like the slightest bit of information might make such a huge difference in a subsequent cycle, or something that can be done differently. So having, I think, a little catch up with the fertility specialist and the treating embryologist who dealt with your case, I think is really, really important. Mm.
That would have been very useful for us, the last two cycles that we've done. I think we would have found that very useful to have had like a debrief meeting with the embryologist, because we kind of knew what happened up until egg retrieval. And then beyond that, it just sort of becomes this sort of space where it's either successful or it's not. But there is a lot that goes on over those 5 or 6 days that could give us clues as to what we might need to do next.
Definitely.
And change the trajectory of our kind of treatment. Yeah. You know.
And ask for notes, ask for embryology notes. Everyone takes embryology notes. So if your lab can produce an embryology report at the end of your treatment, it's so important to have, because even if you decide to move on to another clinic, you can take that with you and they'll be able to see exactly what went on day by day and use that to base a future treatment on or not. You know, it's nice information to be able to have, and that way you know exactly what happened. Really, really important.
Thank you so much for today.
You're welcome. I feel like I'm blabbered on.
No, it's amazing. And it's important, because this is what I mean. Like, it is a bit of an unknown. And I think this conversation today will help people kind of see past the bits that they can't see and understand a bit more. And I think you've given people loads of value and things to take away to advocate for themselves better, ask better questions, you know, and have a deeper understanding of what their cycle's looking like for them. So I'm really grateful.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. And if this podcast is bringing you any value or helping you in any way, what would be really lovely and what we would really appreciate is if you could hop over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a little review, and if you have liked it, give us 5 stars, because this is the thing that will help other people find our podcast too, and that's how podcasts get seen. So it would cost nothing in terms of money and just a few seconds of your time, but would really mean so much to us. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back next time.